All right, thanks a lot for having me here. I was here several years ago. It's nice to be back. So yeah, so today I will talk about some mainly numerical work, but hopefully with some physical insights on quantum spin systems basically undergoing this kind of transition from the standard Nell state to the dimerized state. Actually, I was told I should use this hockey stick as a pointer, but it's a little bit inconvenient to walk over there, so I think I will just make do without a pointer. So, you know, you have the Nell state there on the left, and on the right is an illustration of a dimerized state, so where the spins pair up to form singlets, and those singlets form a kind of crystal. So it turns out that this is an interesting type of phase transition, and it has been under debate for, you know, quite some time now. And one can study this in a specific model that I call the JQ model that I will you know, introduce and discuss the properties of. So I will give a little bit of an introduction to the whole field and then talk about you know, what we can say about this transition from the perspective of specific models that exhibit. And the main thing here is that it turns out that at the transition between these two states, which is actually a continuous transition, you actually have two divergent length scales as you go from the dimer phase into the antiferromagnetic phase. So that has been known, you know, for a long time already. But it looks like you know, people haven't really explored the consequences of that, and that's what we have been doing recently. So the main points I will be making were published in this paper with Wei Shao and Wenang Guo in this paper last year. So Wei Shao is now a postdoc at the Beijing Center for Scientific Computation Research, and she's also spending half her time at BU, and Wenang Guo is her former PhD advisor at Beijing Normal University. Okay, so the general context of, okay, let me actually put this remote in, or maybe I don't need it. The general context of this talk is quantum phase transition. So we know that we can have classical phase transitions where, you know, you change the behavior by thermal fluctuations. And in the same way we can, or almost in the same way, I guess, we can have quantum fluctuations that can be regulated by some parameter g in the Hamiltonian, and that can also drive us between two different phases. So here is just some schematics what we can have. So we can go from an ordered to a disordered phase, and we can do it continuously or discontinuously in both thermal and quantum phase transitions. And the main thing here, of course, is that at the continuous transition, we have a divergent length scale, a correlation length, whereas in the first order transition, that length remains finite at the transition. Okay, so this talk will be focused on this scenario here, where we have a continuous transition. But as you will see, since things will look a little bit odd, people have actually proposed that maybe it's actually a very weakly first order transition. So you can imagine when a first order transition has a very weak discontinuity, it means that the correlation length actually can be quite long, and then it may look like that if you just look at things numerically on small lattices. So let me give you a very simple example of a quantum phase transition as a warm-up. So if you take the spin 1/2 Heisenberg model, you know, so these are nearest neighbor interactions on some lattice. Here I show you two different cases here. One is a bilayer and one is a single layer. So if you just look at the single layer here, we have these red couplings that you should think of as stronger than the blue ones. And when that coupling becomes very large, or the ratio of the couplings becomes very large, then the ground state becomes a trivial singlet product. And on the other side here, we have the antiferromagnetic Nell state. And then it turns out that when you change this coupling ratio, you go continuously from the Nell state to the dimer state. So there's a gap in the spectrum opening here. In the Nell state, you have a gapless spin wave excitations. And this is just illustrating the finite temperature behaviors you have of the correlation length in those phases. That will not be so important for what I'm talking about today. So this kind of phase transition has been studied quite a lot numerically, and one would expect just from symmetries that it should be in the universality class of the 3D O3 or Heisenberg universality class, and it seems to be. So there's actually an experimental realization of almost this kind of situation, just to mention that sometimes we can really check things experimentally as well. So there's this compound thallium copper chloride, which is a three-dimensional network of these dimers, so not a two-dimensional one as I showed in the previous slide. But basically, you have these pairs of quite close to each other copper sites, and they each have a spin 1/2 on them. So if you have such an isolated dimer, you have a singlet on that one. But then it turns out that if you put this material under pressure, you can actually tune the relative coupling strength. So these dimers are coupled to each other in some way, which is not completely known, but it's known sort of. And one can actually go from under at one atmosphere pressure. It's just a quantum disordered state, which means this kind of singlet product where the singlets form on those dimers. But then apparently, as you increase the pressure, these other couplings become relatively stronger, and then you can actually drive it into the Nell state where you actually have a long-range antiferromagnetic order. And then, as is typical around quantum critical points, you have this so-called quantum critical fan here, where you can study all kinds of scaling behaviors that are controlled by this zero temperature critical point. So even if you cannot go exactly to zero temperature, you can actually look at quantum critical scaling even at quite high temperatures. So that's why these quantum phase transitions in some sense are more interesting than classical ones, because the critical region, if you will, is pretty large because you have this finite T region around it. Okay, so that was just an example. So now let's talk about slightly more complicated systems, and now I will not really show any experiments because the phenomenon I will talk about doesn't really have an experimental realization, but it's very interesting in the context of quantum field theories. So I hope you will find that interesting. So basically here now we are looking at situations where we have one spin per unit cell instead of in the previous cases we had two spins per unit cell, and that was why we could have this singlets forming and why the quantum disordered phase really was quite trivial in some sense. So now we start from the Heisenberg model with just equal couplings between nearest neighbors, and it will be on the square lattice. And we put some other coupling there, some other terms which also don't break any lattice symmetry. So one spin per unit cell. So then in addition to the Nell state, we can have basically two classes of other states. So broadly speaking, we can get spin liquids or we can get valence bond solids. So the prototypical RVB spin liquid that I'm sure everybody knows, you can think of as the equal superposition of short valence bonds. But of course, there are many ways to take such a superposition if you put some signs and amplitudes there and so on. So there are many classes of spin liquids, of course. This is just some simple illustration. But the other class of states you can get, it would be the valence bond solids. So there you can think of these singlets as interacting with each other in some way that favors some crystalline structure. So this may look quite similar to the previous case that I showed you where we have a singlet product state, but it's not really, because here this pattern is formed due to spontaneous symmetry breaking instead of the previous case where the Hamiltonian itself had this dimerization. So in the previous case, the ground state is unique, whereas in this case, for example, on the square lattice, the ground state is fourfold degenerate because you can form the columnar pattern in four different ways. And that turns out to be very important. So the transition then, if you look at how we can go from the Nell state into the valence bond solid, which is what I will talk about today, is much more complicated than the simple cases I talked about before. So in particular, there have been proposals, and this goes back quite far in time already, that the transition between the nail state and the valence bond solid may be beyond Landau-Ginzburg in the sense of what we expect the order of the transition to be and so on, and even how we describe the phase transition using field theories. So the important paper here that really sort of proposed this scenario was by these authors here already more than 10 years ago, but there were a lot of prior works that were very important, basically to find out how one describes the valence bond solid in a field theory. This paper was the first that proposed that you can really have a continuous transition, generically a continuous transition between these two phases. So that's the phenomenon we will be studying. So in the standard scenario, we'd expect that to be generically first order because you break two unrelated symmetries here. So then you should get this kind of continuous transition only at some fine-tuned multicritical point, but not generically. So I will not talk much about the field theory description here, just to say that in this scenario, what happens is that the valence bond solid is basically generated by topological defects in the field theory. Let me just flash the field theory without really saying what it is. But those topological defects are supposed to be irrelevant at the critical point itself. So that actually means that just to study the phase transition, you can neglect the topological defects. So this so-called CP1 theory, which is a theory of spinors coupled to a gauge field, you can study it without considering topological defects in the gauge field. So if you want to describe this phase here, you have to consider the topological defects, which are monopoles in this gauge field description. But then you need additional terms here and so on. So this is the theory that was proposed to describe the critical point. And what was also done was large N studies, so one can generalize this SU2 model to SUN and then do 1/n expansions, and based on those it was proposed that the transition is continuous. So when n is very large, one can show that the transition is continuous, but it cannot be proven rigorously when n is small, in particular when n equals 2. So that's one thing that we would like to really confirm this scenario for SU2 and maybe other small n. And then the thing which I will mainly focus on here is that, okay, since this theory doesn't really contain these topological defects, and it turns out that these topological defects should be associated with a second divergent length scale of the problem. If that second length scale actually turns out to be of some importance here, you have basically thrown the baby out with the bathwater in this model. So that will be one of the main things I will discuss. So what are the consequences of two length scales? But before that, let me talk about what are really those two length scales. Why do we have two divergent length scales here? So this strange sounding term, dangerously irrelevant perturbation, that goes back, quite some time in classical stat mech. So, for example, in clock models, you have such things. So this was already studied by these authors in 1977. Namely, you take an XY model, and in this case, it should be in three dimensions, and then you add this kind of perturbation, which favors certain clock angles, so in this case q equals 6, so equally spaced angles. And it turns out that this perturbation is dangerously irrelevant. So what does that mean? It means that, okay, when you don't have the term there, you have a phase transition in the, which is just the phase transition of the XY model, right? and it has certain critical exponents and so on. So when you add that term, no matter how strong it is, what is the value of H, you still have a 3D XY transition. So it's irrelevant in that sense. But of course, if you go in the ordered state, it changes the nature of the symmetry breaking in the ordered state. So it is relevant in the ordered state, but not at the critical point. So that's what dangerously irrelevant means. So if you look at some kind of RG flow in this model, you can understand more or less what this second length is. So here we have a phase diagram in terms of some coupling G, which is just, if we just look at this kind of model, it's the inverse temperature. And on this side, or on that axis, we have the strength of this dangerous irrelevant coupling as you do some RG. And now I want to imagine that the RG is actually done by coarse graining. So as you move on these curves, you increase the length scale, okay? So then if you are exactly at the critical point, okay, this dangerous perturbation becomes irrelevant, so you just flow to the critical point. If you are at high temperatures, you flow to the paramagnetic phase, where that also is irrelevant. But if you are at low temperature, below the critical temperature, then initially you start to flow towards this fixed point here. But then when you sense that you are not really at criticality, you start to flow toward this U1 fixed point, the normal ordered state of the XY model. But you don't get there, because then this irrelevant perturbation kicks in at some point and throws you towards this point Q, which corresponds to symmetry breaking of this Q-fold symmetric order parameter. Okay, so since I told you that I want to think about the flow in terms of lengths, we can associate the normal correlation length with the point where you start to deviate from the critical point, okay, at that length scale. And then we can associate another length scale where you start to go away from the U1 fixed point. So in that sense, you can understand that there are two divergent lengths here, because of course, as you go closer to the critical point, both of those become larger and larger. Okay, so, yeah.
And in which sense then is this irrelevant?
Because it doesn't affect the critical exponent. So you still flow to the same fixed point X.
When you don't have the perturbation?
No, even when you have the perturbation. So this is...
You flow close to it?
Yeah, no, even when you have the perturbation, if you are at the critical temperature of that model, exactly, you flow to the same fixed point. Right. So that the stronger your... If you look at this for different strengths of the perturbation, of course the flows will look different in terms of how close you get to the critical point and so on. But you know, they still qualitatively will look the same.
So what about the H equal infinity limit?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I will actually talk about that in a moment. So even the H equals infinity limit will you will have the same flows. Yeah. So that would correspond to what some people really call the clock model, where these angles are really restricted to be one of these clock angles, not just that you have some higher energy for being away from them. Okay, so you can think of this as a crossover length scale from U1 symmetry to what you eventually have, the ZQ symmetry. Okay, so this can actually be observed in Monte Carlo simulations. So let me show that, because I think it can make it more clear in some sense if we do that. So, and now I will actually consider the case that Michel mentioned, namely the clock model, where I don't even put in that term, I just say, okay, my spins can only point in those, in this case, six directions, okay? So then when we do simulations, we can measure some, the order parameter, for example. So since we are in two dimensions, or the order parameter is two-dimensional, we have mx and my, and I can define those in the standard way. And then I can not just look at the order parameter, but I can look at the probability distribution of the order parameter. So here you see, okay, so this is actually for an eight-state model. So you can see on the left side here, that's for a pretty small system. So both of these cases are for t less than tc. So now you see a very wide and narrow ring here. So that means that the order parameter is essentially U1 symmetric. If you look at the angular variations, they are very small. So although the individual spins are restricted to these angles, once you take averages, which is like coarse graining, these angles can take so many values that it looks pretty much continuous. But when you go to a bigger system size, then you clearly see that you have eight bright spots there. So now we have gone from a U1 symmetric order parameter, effectively speaking, to an eightfold symmetric one. Okay, so now we can quantify this if we want to do some quantitative studies on this kind of crossover here. We can just integrate the probability distribution as a function of angle with cosine q theta. So that will be essentially zero here, and it will be large there. Okay? So this is some work in progress here. In addition to that MQ order parameter, we can look at some more conventional things. For example, we can look at the Binder cumulant, which is basically the ratio of two powers of n4 to m squared. And then with some constant here, and this is made such that this will be zero if we are in the paramagnetic phase, it will be one in the ordered phase, and it has some universal value at the critical point. Okay, so this is something I can now construct some flows with, similar to what you have in the RG. So here on the x-axis, and this is for a six-state model. I didn't say that here, but this is what it is. So this is the Binder cumulant for that model defined in this way. And this is that other order parameter which tells us how angular anisotropic we are. So these numbers will both be between 0 and 1. And you see here I do different temperatures and different sizes, and everything is sort of focused in this corner here. So the main plot here is a blow up of that region. So now you can see that here we really do what I explained in the RG flows, that we do increasing system sizes and we check how we flow in this coordinate system. So if we look first at when t is very close to tc, these violet circles here, then you see that we just flow down to 0 m6 here, meaning that angular anisotropy goes away, and we flow to that universal value. If I'm above tc, we flow towards 0 here. And if we are below tc, it looks like initially that we're just going to flow to this point here, but at least if we're a little bit deeper in the ordered phase, we see that eventually actually the system crosses over and we start to flow away from that point corresponding to the fixed point. So in principle, we could actually extract these two length scales from this diagram. We could say, okay, the normal correlation length would be the point where, let's say, you are closest to this fixed point here. And similarly, the other length scale would be the point on these curves where I'm closest to that point. We haven't done that yet because these curves are a little bit noisy, but hopefully they will get smoother soon. But at least as a matter of principle, I guess, you can now see how this RG flow can be connected to observables that you can actually compute in simulations. Okay, but now we're not interested in classical systems, although they are also quite interesting, but let's continue talking about these valence bond solids in quantum spin models. So now we would like to have a model that can actually give us the valence bond solid. And there are many models where people believe that we have valence bond solids. But one problem is that it's not always easy to study those models in simulations because of what's called the sign problem, which I'm sure many of you know about. So that's basically the fact that when we do quantum Monte Carlo, our configurations do not have positive definite weights, so we cannot apply standard Monte Carlo techniques. So what we need basically is a model that doesn't have that sign problem, but still gives us the VBS. And it turns out you can get that if you consider certain multi-spin interactions. So the Heisenberg interaction is just a singlet projector on nearest neighbor sites. And now we can take product of such singlet projectors, and we can consider all translations and rotations of those products. In the simplest case, it would be just the model would just be the Heisenberg term plus some number, which we call Q, or it should be minus, actually, because we want to favor alignment of dimers. So this would be the JQ model, where we have this term here. I can also consider that interaction, but I will not do that here. Okay, so it turns out that, as was shown in this paper here, that this model, in fact, has a transition into a VBS state. It's not supposed to be a realistic description of any material, but it's simply designed, so we call it a designer Hamiltonian, to study this particular phenomenon. Well, actually, you know, I do pray every night that the people working on optical lattices will eventually make this model, but okay, let's see. It's probably not so easy. So let's use this model to test the deconfined criticality scenario and look at some other aspects that were not even discussed in deconfined criticality. So let me just show a few results to convince you that at least it looks like the system has a continuous critical point. So we need to look at the order parameter. So the order parameter of the Nell state is just the sublattice magnetization. And then the dimer order, since you know, the dimer is basically some bond where S dot S is large, we can define X and Y dimer order parameters in this way. So this would be large, positive or negative if we have horizontal dimers, and this would be large if the dimers are vertical. And then in the simulations, we look at the squared order parameters. Okay, here I just flash some results. So you can see that there's a coupling ratio here where both these look like power laws, right? And as we go away from that point, you get behaviors that you would expect around a critical point. An interesting thing here is that these slopes are actually essentially the same. So that can be translated into these anomalous dimensions for the spin and dimer order being essentially the same. And well, you could then ask, are they actually exactly the same? And there's some proposal that they actually should be the same, that there should actually be an emergent SO5 symmetry in these models. This work actually considered a different model, but with essentially the same kinds of behaviors. I will not really talk about that today, but it's...
So this combines like the SO3 of the first?
Yeah, so that would be, you know, the O3 of this one.
Yeah.
And this is, since we have emergent U1 symmetry, we believe, of this one, it's combining the O3 and U1. Yeah. Oh, okay, so here there is no reference yet to divergent lengths. This is just looking at the critical order parameter. So what, okay, I talked about the two lengths before for the clock model. Let's see if we can do something similar in this JQ model. So I mentioned already that the field theory if you want to describe the VBS, has condensation of topological defects, and the topological defects are supposed to be dangerously irrelevant. So in the same sense as in the clock model, we should then expect a second length scale in the problem. and this is actually you know, what you expect in terms of RG flows. So on this axis, you would just have some coupling that can take you from the antiferromagnet to, in this case, a spin liquid. And then we have a fixed point corresponding to the VBS up there. and on the vertical axis here, we have, you can say that it's the strength of the irrelevant perturbation, but you can also say that it's just the fugacity of topological defects. So then, if we are exactly at the critical point, we flow there. If we are on this side, we flow to the antiferromagnet. And on that side, initially, we start to flow toward this U1 fixed point. But at some length, we start to flow to the VBS. So again, we could associate some, you know, length scales corresponding to the correlation length and this other length. Okay. Right. So, and again, if
just going to ask a question.
Yeah.
So, when you have these dangerously irrelevant in case of classical phase transition,
right?
The irrelevant operators can be computed from the leading scaling fields, right?
Yeah. So you can.
So I guess
they would be not the leading scaling fields, right? I mean, they would be scaling corrections. So that they would be irrelevant fields at the critical point and relevant in, yeah.
But here, we don't. Do we know what are the scaling exponents for the theory for the?
No, I don't think it's known.
Okay.
Because again, all the calculations that can be done basically for large n and for the model that, okay, so even if you don't include them in the model, of course you could calculate the scaling dimensions if you just, you know, look at some correlation functions or if you analyze the conformal field theory in some other way. But such calculations have really been done only for large n, right? So what our goal is to really test all kinds of aspects of this scenario, you know, using unbiased numerics. Okay, so if you recall what I showed for the clock model, I showed these kinds of similar order parameter histograms. So these are from actual simulations of this JQ inside the valence bond solid phase. And again, you can think of this as a small system, or actually I think this is a system close to the critical point. They're actually the same size systems. Close to the critical point, this looks U1 symmetric, and if I go further away from the critical point, you clearly see that there's a four-fold symmetry here. So now we can proceed as we did in the clock model. We can define some order parameter that picks up this asymmetry here, and we can also look at Binder accumulants to test in what phase we are. But in this case, we have two ordered phases. We have the Knell phase and the dimer phase. So that means we can actually also define two different Binder accumulants. And individually, they should have the properties that, okay, if you don't have any magnetic order, then this one is zero. If you don't have any dimer order, this one is zero. And in the extreme case of going to large systems and so on, they would go to one in the ordered phase. But now, since we want to look at, you know, some diagram which only has one x-axis, I can look at the difference between these Binder accumulants. Then that should flow to minus one if I'm in the Knell phase, and it should flow to plus one if I'm in the dimer phase. Okay? So here are some results I've shown. And again, now we look at increasing system sizes, and we see how things flow. And it looks similar, maybe not exactly like it did in the clock model, but you can see there's some point that we have determined using other means to be the critical point, and then you, for the very small system, there's a little kink, and then it flows towards that point. And that point seems to be very close to zero, which actually may again be a hint of maybe this SO5 symmetry, because there is no a priori reason that the universal values of UD and UM should be exactly the same, right, at criticality. But they appear to be, or at least very close to each other. Okay, and then you see that on one side we flow towards minus one, which corresponds to the antiferromagnetic phase. And on this side, it looks like we first start to flow toward this point here, which would be basically a U1 spin liquid. But at some system size, we start to turn up and flow away from that point. So again, you could define two length scales corresponding to the initial flowing away from the critical point and from flowing away from the U1 fixed point. But we haven't done that because, again, the curves are a bit noisy still to do that. Okay, so this was just basically to illustrate that we have two length scales. So now let me talk a bit about how we determine critical exponents. And then in a little while, I will try to tell you that this second length scale actually will impact some of the critical exponents that we see in finite size scaling. So what is finite size scaling? By the way, there was a typo in my abstract, and it was not my fault, I have to say. So if you looked at the abstract posted online maybe yesterday, it said that I will look at night size scaling, and that sounded very exciting, and I heard from some of you like Gifre that they looked forward to hearing about this new concept of night size scaling, but it was unfortunately just two letters had dropped out there. all right, so if we look at a system in the thermodynamic limit and we go to a critical point, here I just wrote it as a classical T goes to TC, but it could be a quantum critical point as well. We know that we have a divergent correlation length. And here delta is just T minus TC. And if we look at some other singular quantity, for example, the order parameter or some susceptibility, we can always express that in the correlation length, right, in this way, if this is some generic exponent kappa for whatever quantity we are looking at. So then it really is as simple as replacing the correlation length by L if we want to know how that quantity scales with system size at the critical point, or let's say very close to the critical point. So you just get that exponent there. Okay, so more precisely, if you also want to know what happens if you go away from the critical point a bit, you get some function of L divided by the correlation length, multiplying that power of L. And by just taking some suitable power of that, you can write that argument as delta L to 1 over nu. Okay, and this function is non-singular as the argument goes to zero. So at the critical point, you just recover that behavior. So let me show you some examples here. This is from a 2D icing model calculation. So here is the susceptibility as a function of the temperature. And you see that I get these peaks here. And if we replot that using this function, namely, we divide out the L power, and on the x-axis I plot as a function of this argument here, you can see that curves for different system sizes collapse onto the same curve, which then is that function f. Okay? In this case, we actually, of course, because it's the 2D Ising model, we know what these exponents are. So kappa is minus gamma, if we go back to that form here. So I could just do that immediately. We even know the critical temperature. So I can define my delta if I know TC. If we don't know these, then we can just treat them as fitting parameters and try to get the best collapse we can. And you should notice here that, of course, the collapse is not perfect. The small sizes always have some deviations. And that's due to the fact that there are some other arguments in the scaling function which depend on irrelevant fields. Once that become go away, the effects go away as the system size grows. And actually, maybe I can make a comment here because you know everybody you know studying criticality and finite size scaling will see plots like this, and it looks very good. So in some sense, we are being spoiled because in the Ising model, the corrections are really very small. And that's why this works even when the system sizes are pretty small. If you go to more complicated, say, cases, it may not look as nice. But let me analyze these exponents a little bit more careful. So you could do something like this. If you don't know the exponents, you can just try to do the data collapse. But it's not so easy to do that very systematically. So let's do it more systematically. Let's look at the Binder cumulant that I showed you before for the clock models. So here you see how the Binder cumulant evolves to a step function as the system size increases. And if we zoom in here, you can see that these curves cross each other. So the asymptotic crossing point would be exactly at TC here. But it's not easy to see here, but there are actually some drifts in the crossing points. So if we blow things up a little bit, and here I just look at three different system sizes, you can see that they really don't cross each other exactly at one point. But now what you can do is you can, well, so the drift is due again to a scaling correction that was not included in the way I wrote the scaling function. So basically what we can do is we can take pairs of these curves, for example, 16 and 32 and 32 and 64 and so on, and we can check how things drift as a function of L, you know, with these pairs. So that's shown here for many different system sizes. So you see here the horizontal crossing point flows to some value, and the vertical crossing point as well. And according to scaling theory, if you do things with corrections, we expect that the correction here is a power law, which contains you know, one of these, well, the leading irrelevant exponent. So here I didn't put in any prior knowledge at all, and it turns out I get TC to maybe 8 significant digits or something like that, which again is not maybe typical, but it's because the corrections decay away very fast here. These exponents are pretty large. We can also actually get the correlation length exponent from this. We can look at the slopes of these curves. So if we look at some combination of the slopes, we can extract an estimate of one of a new, and you see that flows into one, which is correct. It should be one in the Ising model. And again, this works so well because this exponent here is close to 2 in the Ising model. So the correction decays away very fast. Well, then I go this way. Okay, let's return to the JQ model. And I showed all this because this is what we did for the JQ model in this paper here. So we looked at, again, you know, Binder ratio. You can do the cumulant or ratio. It doesn't really matter. So you can see here again, for some system sizes, the bin accumulant has some crossing points, and we can analyze those. But now you can see it doesn't look as maybe nice as it did for the icing model. So this is the drift of the horizontal crossing point here. And you can see that it's even non-monotonic, right? It goes down and then it goes up. And of course, we are sort of hoping that it's not non-monotonic again. At this point, we can just fit it. Well, the one of a new exponent, that size dependence actually is monotonic, so that helps. So then again, we can analyze these, and for example, for the most important case of the correlation length exponent, we get actually quite a small value. But here you can see that the corrections are really large. If we only have small sizes, and if we don't do this kind of analysis, we may actually get a very wrong value. Okay, so here, if we have a first order transition, it turns out one also has finite size scaling, but the exponents in that case are trivial, basically one over dimensionality, for example, for nu. So if the transition is first order here, we should actually flow to 3 here, which this fit doesn't do, but you may still say that, okay, can we exclude that? Maybe we cannot completely exclude that. So in fact, this has been the story now for many years, that we analyze the results. Some results look like they should at a continuous transition, but other quantities look quite strange. And that has prompted some groups to also claim that this really is a first order transition in this and similar models. So let me show an example of that anomalous scaling. So we study systems on a torus, right? We have periodic space and time boundaries in the simulations. And then, as illustrated in this graph here, we can define winding numbers. We can basically, if we map the spins to hardcore bosons, we can count windings around the temporal and spatial boundaries. And that winding number is actually related to physical properties of the system that we can basically extract from windings. So the spatial winding is related to the spin stiffness, which is basically an elasticity constant of the system. And the temporal winding is related to the magnetic susceptibility. Okay, so if we look at standard scaling theory, it tells us that these quantities should scale as 1 over L. And that implies that the winding number squared should flow to a constant, okay, because of this relationship here. And what people have seen is something that doesn't quite look like that. So here is the winding number, should go to a constant, seems to be more divergent. And actually, if it diverges linearly, that corresponds to a first order transition. Okay, I had a paper a few years ago where I also analyzed this, and I found that it doesn't really diverge linearly. It's more like a logarithmic divergence, or maybe a power law with a small exponent. So what's going on here? So I don't think this looks like scaling as L. So maybe there is some new physics here, and maybe it's related to the two length scales. So that's what I want to try to convince you in the last 10 minutes or so. Okay, two length scales. I talked about the two length scales in terms of these RG flows, but the second length scale also has a much more concrete manifestation, namely as the thickness of a domain wall. So if you take the clock model, for example, that we talked about, and you lock the boundaries in different clock states, you will get a domain wall, and the domain wall should scale, the thickness of it should scale with this second length exponent. Okay, so then you can, well, it turns out it's not so easy actually to measure the thickness of a domain wall, because the domain wall itself can slush around and it's not so easy to just say what the thickness is. But we can ask what is the free energy cost of a domain wall. And without going through derivations, I can tell you that the free energy divided by, if it's 2D, just the length of the domain wall, should scale in this way. So it contains both length scales. So if we go to these valence bond solids in quantum systems, you can do something similar. And there we're looking at the ground state energy cost of a domain wall. So here what we did, we locked the two sides of the system into different VBS patterns, and then you see you have domain walls in between. Actually, in this case, you even have two domain walls in between, it turns out. And those that energy should scale in the same way. Okay, so let's look at finite size scaling of these domain wall energies. So first, let's look at the clock model. I already defined it, so I don't need to tell you what it is. But this is what you expect in the thermodynamic limit. But now you can already see that we have a problem here, because when we go to finite size scaling, what I told you before is that we should replace the correlation length by the system length. But now we have two length scales, so which one should we actually replace by L? Maybe both, maybe just one of them. So let's look at that. So when we look at this domain wall in this model, at the critical point, we see that this domain wall free energy cost scales to zero, as we expect. And we can try to extract what the exponent is. Again, there are corrections. We look at size pairs. We just say, okay, what is the slope of the line going between those sizes? And then we can extrapolate that to infinite size. And it certainly looks like that's going to 2 here, which means that we should replace this by 1 over L squared. So that seemed to show that in this case, we should replace both by L. Okay, that is not completely crazy. How about the JQ model? Okay, as I mentioned, we can actually, depending on the boundary conditions, we can actually get 1 or 2 domain walls, because this is actually the elementary domain wall. So if I make the boundaries like that, this that looks like a domain wall here actually breaks up into 2 domain walls like that, turns out, as you show here, as you see here. So then it looks like in between. So here you've got some horizontal bonds as well, because we get another face in between. And the domain walls themselves look like they have plaquette order. Okay, so now we can just look at, in some ways, which I will not really discuss, look at the finite size scaling of the energy cost of the domain wall, which in the thermodynamic limit should scale that way. Okay, so this is what we get, and we can do it for both kinds of domain walls. This is the energy cost itself, and this is the exponent that we extract from system size pairs. So that should go to 1 plus the ratio of these two different exponents. Okay? Well, okay, I should say this first. It goes to whatever it goes, but what is that? So now the question is again, what should we replace by the system size? So you can write this exponent as, or this correlation, this length as the correlation length to the ratio of these. Or you can express that one in that one. So we have basically three different ways that we could replace lengths by the system length. And they would give different predictions in terms of the L scaling. Okay, what we find here is that this exponent is less than 2. So that means that the third option is what we actually get. We didn't get the second option that we got in the classical clock model. Okay, so this is completely unexpected and also very interesting and useful, because if this is correct, it actually gives us what the ratio between these two exponents is, right? Okay, so now we have a number, and now we can start to see if we have something similar in other quantities. Can we get some consistent description of other quantities where this ratio should also appear? And I'm almost done. So basically, if we have some quantity that in the thermodynamic limit scales in a certain way, and if I generalize the finite size scaling form we had before to two length scales, then we can see what power of L we need in front of F. So the standard scenario is just to say, well, the second length scale doesn't do anything to our physical quantities. So if we forget about the second argument, if the first argument controls the behavior for when the argument is large, this is the prefactor we need, okay, in order to get this thermodynamic limit. But there is an alternative scenario that seems to be not excluded from any fundamental principles, namely that it's the second argument that is important when both arguments become large. Because we don't really know what this scaling function F is. We say, okay, there's a scaling function, but we don't know what it is, unless somebody carries out an RG calculation and actually tells us, which we haven't done. But let's see what is the consequence of, well, so as the consequence, here we have to have a different power of L in front, okay? So an example, the spin stiffness that we talked about a little bit before, this is the conventional finite size scaling power. In the second scenario, that exponent is modified by nu of a nu prime, okay? And this was basically considered something that you have to have, otherwise something is wrong. But I don't see anything wrong with this one. So let's see if it works, because now from the domain wall calculation, we actually have a prediction for this ratio. Okay, so does that work? So for the particular case we're looking at, d equals 2 and z equals 1, this is what we expect. And this is what we may have. And if we look at data for, you know, multiplying these by L to cancel that L factor, they don't go to constants, which I also showed you before. But one can actually describe them with this epsilon, this nu of a nu prime that we extracted before. But here we actually needs to take into account scaling correction. So this is the floating exponent if I just fit pairs of sizes. And this is where we would like it to go. And, you know, maybe it does, but maybe this is not super convincing. Well, luckily it was convincing enough for the referees and editors of science, I guess. But still, we want to do further tests. And I think I will just flash the results, because now we have done further tests that are not published yet. So basically, if we do corrections to scaling, we expect things to have these L powers that eventually decay away. So these would be the leading corrections. And actually, you know, it seems like the leading correction has a small exponent, and that's why it's very hard to analyze things. But now our observation is that these prefactors actually depend on the aspect ratio of inverse temperature and system size that we do in the simulations. And therefore, if we choose these aspect ratios, or this R, in a certain way, maybe we can minimize the scaling corrections. And in fact, that seems to be the case. Let me just skip this and just show the final one. So now we have found optimal aspect ratios for these two quantities that we are looking at. The aspect ratios are different for the two quantities. And it turns out in this model, which seems not to be generic, but in this model it's true, that we can actually make the leading correction completely vanish. So, you know, if I just flash back and show you what we had in this science paper here, we had these flows of this anomalous exponent. So we are pretty far away from the value we hope it's going to. The same thing now when we have gone to these special aspect ratios. You know, it's this curve, these here. So you see, these scale very nicely into a value which is completely consistent with this 0.28. These other colors just show what happens if you go a little bit away from the critical point, and it behaves as expected. So this seems now really much more than a coincidence. It really seems like we have this anomalous finite size scaling behavior. And I can just quickly mention that since finite temperature in a path integral is like finite size in the imaginary time dimension, we should all, well, we have had already observed anomalous scaling in temperature, and we can now also explain those with the same nu over nu prime ratio. And this is, of course, more experimentally relevant because this is really what you do in experiments. You look at things in this quantum critical fan that I illustrated before, and you may look at, for example, the susceptibility. Normally, you would expect it to go linear in T. Here it goes like T to some small power. Okay, so I think I will just stop here and put up my conclusions, and thank you.
Are there any new implications regarding, you know, this CPM minus one? Do the critical exponents match?
Right. Well, the thing is that there are really no, you know, calculations of the critical. Okay, so there's this one large N calculations for the critical exponents. So we have some work that was done already some years ago where we look at SUN generalizations of these models, and we can match the critical exponents quite well to the 1 over N calculations. But that was for some different quantities. We didn't you know, look at these quantities so much, which we also should do. So we are actually in the process of looking at these things for SUN models as well. And of course, here the exponent should always be, well, the standard result is that the exponent should always be 1 over L here, and now we have this anomalous form. And the question is, if we see this anomalous form and all this consistency also for SUN. But other things in terms of the field theory, I don't really know, because these are things that, you know, people doing the field theories haven't really addressed at all, so it's hard to say.
Would it be a non-perturbative effect in the field
theory? Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, yeah. Well, it's not completely clear, because you can say, okay, if you do, you know, 1 over n, then 1 over n is a perturbative effect. So does it appear in the 1 over n? So far, I don't know really if people have ask the questions, I cannot tell. But that certainly if you go, if it's something that happens only for small n, then it's a non-perturbative effect. Yeah, that's a good question. Oh, okay, that's also an interesting thing. Yeah, so people have applied the conformal bootstrap to, you know, SO5 theory. So now, you know, there's this proposal that this deconfined criticality for SU2 also has SO5 symmetry. And people doing the conformal bootstrap have some results for that. And they claim, for example, that eta has to be larger than 0.6. And the etas I showed you were around 0.3. So that doesn't seem to be consistent. But I'm not sure if this is something one can really trust completely yet or what. Well, maybe both, right? Well, actually, so, you know, we have, you know, this prediction for how finite size scaling exponents are modified now by this ratio here. But we don't know how, you know, correlation functions that we use to extract eta, how, if they are also affected. Because here, we have something that in the standard case goes like 1 over L. So if it's not 1 over L, we know that it's something anomalous. But nobody knows what the anomalous exponents are. So if we just see, you know, some power law behavior there, we don't know is that anomalous behavior or not, right? It's only for quantities that have some, okay, so in this case, the exponent depends only on the dynamic exponent Z, which we strongly believe is equal to 1, so that's why this works. But in the other, yeah, for the etas, we don't really know if we have anomalous exponents there or not.
So I think in all the work on simulations of, I think, XY and Heisenberg model,
right,
what you can do is you can add terms which suppress topological defects mm-hmm. and show that the critical behavior is modified there.
Yeah, that's right.
And so can it be done here for trying to suppress the topological defects and see if things have changed?
Well, yeah, so I mean, if you just study classical Heisenberg models, you can say, okay, let's go and look at the configurations and see if we have topological defects. If you have, you don't include that configuration. Here, the representation we use in the simulation is not one of continuous spins. It's just, we have up and down spins and we have this higher dimension and so on. I don't know how to identify a topological defect in the representation that we are actually using. Maybe it's possible, I just don't know. Of course, then the theory says that we should have no topological defects at the transition anyway, so we shouldn't see them, but we could go to some other models that should have them and maybe compare. Yeah.
Anders, you've presented a very careful analysis of a scenario where you have two divergent length
right.
scales. So the analysis was very careful, but my question is much more simple than this. So when you started discussing this, you said intuitively these two length scales are attached to how close you go through two different fixed points. One was the critical fixed point,
right.
The other one was the UR.
Right.
So there was some order in how you were going through close to this fixed point. And my question is whether that could all Yeah, you had this.
Yeah, let me pull up the picture. So we can just look at maybe the classical. Maybe you mean that.
For instance, here, right? You said.
Sorry.
Yeah. So you said that one line scale may have to do with how close you are to fix the first one, then the other.
Right.
So this gives you a hierarchy, right? These
yep.
two scales that are.
That's right. Yeah. So exactly.
And
so you have two relevant operators there, and one is larger and one is smaller. Yeah.
So wouldn't that automatically tell you something about now what you want to do is you go back to the fixed point and start finite size corrections.
Right.
Or the
yeah,
size.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So.
So do you expect that the fact that these two different divergent length scales come from different are attached to different fixed points?
Right.
One comes first, then the other. That
uh-huh.
this implies already how you should expect these finite size corrections to go with chi and chi prime.
Well, I think in the standard scenario, the answer is yes. But our results don't seem to fit with the standard scenario, so then I cannot tell you. The only thing I really can say is that we have a phenomenological scaling ansatz that seems to consistently describe, you know, all the data that we have. But definitely we would like to understand this more along the lines that you are talking about, but we definitely don't do that yet.
If there are more questions,
thank you.